Archmaester Ebrose, who has made a study of all known accounts of the affliction, believes that it is spread by the butterflies that the peaceful people revere. For this reason, the disease is often called butterfly fever. Some believe the fever is carried only by one particular sort of butterfly, a large black and white variety with wings as big as a man's hand, is favored by Ebrose. But this remains conjecture. Whether the butterflies of Narth are true handmaids of the Lord of Harmony, or no more than common insects like their cousins in the Seven Kingdoms, it may well be that the Nathi are not wrong in regarding them as guardians. Sad to say, the corsairs who prowled the seas around Narth long ago learned that the chances of dying of butterfly fever were low so long as they did not remain upon the island for more than a few hours, and lower still if they only came ashore at night, for butterflies are creatures of the day and love the morning dew and the afternoon sun. Thus it is that slavers from the Basilisk Isles oft descend upon Narth during the dark of night to carry off whole villages into bondage. The peaceful people always bring good prices, it is said, for they are as clever as they are gentle, fair to look upon, and quick to learn obedience. It is reported that one pillow house on Lys is famed for its Narthi girls, who are clad in diaphanous silken gowns and adorned with gaily painted butterfly wings. Such raids had become so frequent since the Century of Blood that the peaceful people have largely abandoned their own shores, moving inland to the hills and forests, where it is harder for the slavers to find them. Thus the fine handicrafts, shimmering silks, and delicate spiced wines of the Isle of Butterflies are seen less and less in the markets of the Seven Kingdoms and the Nine Free Cities. The Basilisk Isles. East of Narth, the long chain of islands known as the Basilisk Isles could not be more different. Named for the fierce beasts that once infested them, the basilisks had for long centuries been the festering sore of the summer sea, inhabited only by corsairs, pirates, slavers, sellswords, murderers, and monsters, the worst of humanity. They come from every land beneath the sun, it is said, for only here can such men hope to find others of their own ilk. Life on the basilisks is nasty, brutal, and off short. Hot, humid, and swarming with stinging flies, sand fleas, and bloodworms. These islands have always proved singularly unhealthy for man and beast alike. Ruins found upon the Isle of Tears, the Isle of Toads, and Axe Island hint at some ancient civilization. But little is now known of these vanished men of the Dawn Age. If any still survived when the first corsairs settled on the islands, they were soon put to the sword, so no trace of them now remains, save perhaps upon the Isle of Toads, as we shall discuss shortly. The largest of the basilisks is the Isle of Tears, where steep-sided valleys and black bugs hide amongst the rugged flint hills and twisted, wind-swept rocks. On its southern coast stand the broken ruins of a city, founded by the old empire of Gis. It was known as Gorgai for close on two centuries, or perhaps four, there is some dispute, until the Dragon Lords of Valeria captured it during the Third Gascari War and renamed it Gogossus. By any name, it was an evil place. The Dragon Lords sent their worst criminals to the Isle of Tears to live out their lives in hard labor. In the dungeons of Gogossus, torturers devised new torments. In the flesh pits, blood sorcery of the darkest sort was practiced, as beasts were mated to slave women to bring forth twisted, half-human children. The infamy of Gogossus outlived even the doom. During the Century of Blood, this dark city wax rich and powerful. Some called her their tenth free city. But her wealth was built on slaves and sorcery. Her slave markets became as notorious as those of the old Gascari cities on Slaver's Bay. 77 years after the doom of Valeria, however, it is said their stink reached even the nostrils of the gods, and a terrible plague emerged from the slave pens of Gogossus. The Red Death swept across the Isle of Tears, then the rest of the Basilisk Isles. 9 men of every 10 died screaming, bleeding copiously from every orifice, their skin shredding like wet parchment. For a century thereafter, the basilisks were shunned. It was not until the coming of the corsairs that men returned to the isles once again. The Carthene pirate, Zendar Azor, was the first to raise his banner there, using the stones he found on Axe Isle to erect a grim black fort above his anchorage. The men of the Brotherhood of Bones soon followed, settling at the western end of the chain upon the Isle of Flies. From these bases, Zendaro and the Brotherhood were perfectly placed to prey upon merchantmen, rounding the shattered, smoking remnants of the Valerian Peninsula. Within half a century, almost everyone of the basilisks was home to a nest of corsairs.
A few of the Basilisk Isles have certain unique aspects that warrant further mention. Talon, a large claw-shaped island north of the Isle of Tears, is honeycombed with deep caves, most of them inhabited and fortified. This island serves as a slave mart for the corsairs, where captives are held until they can be sold or, less often, ransomed. It is also home to Barter Beach, where the pirates trade with one another. On the Isle of Toads can be found an ancient idol, a greasy black stone crudely carved in the semblance of a gigantic toad of malignant aspect, some 40 feet high. The people of this isle are believed by some to be descended from those who carved the toadstone, for there is an unpleasant fish-like aspect to their faces, and many have webbed hands and feet. If so, they are the sole surviving remnant of this forgotten race. Many of the corsairs cling to the gruesome custom of festooning the hulls and masts of their ships with severed heads to strike fear into their foes. The heads dangle from hempen rope until all the flesh has rotted off them, whereupon they are replaced with fresh ones. Rather than consign the skulls to the sea, however, the corsairs will deliver them to Skull Isle as an offering to some dark god. Thus it is that great piles of yellowed skulls can be seen lining the shores of this small, windswept, uninhabited rock.
In our present day, the Brotherhood of Bones is long forgotten, and all that remains of Zendar Azor is the fort he left on Axe Isle. But the corsairs still haunt the basilisks. Once every generation, it seems, fleets are sent to the islands to clear out these vermin of the seas. The Valentines have been especially assiduous in this regard, often in alliance with one or more of the other free cities. Some of these raids have ended in failure when the corsairs fled forewarned. Others, more ably led, have seen hundreds hanged and scores of ships seized or sunk or put to the torch. One ended in infamy when the Lycine captain Sartha San, commanding the fleet sent to destroy the corsair strongholds, himself turned pirate and reigned as king of the Basilisk Isles for 30 years. No matter the outcome of such efforts, the corsairs always seem to resume their depredations after a time. Their towns sprout up like toadstools, only to be abandoned the next year or the year after, left to rot away and sink back into the mud and slime from which they rose. Port Plunder, the most famous of them, is celebrated in many a song and story, yet cannot be found on any map. For the good and sufficient reason that there have been at least a dozen port plunders on as many islands. Whenever one is destroyed, another is founded, only to be abandoned in turn. The same is true of Stye, Whore's Gash, Black Pudding, and all the other pirate lairs, each viler and more infamous than the last. In summary, the Basilisk Isles are best avoided, for no good has ever come to those who journey hence. So Thorius. Men have known of the existence of the vast savage land to the south, since the first of them took to the sea in ships, for only the width of the summer sea separates Sothoris from the ancient civilizations and great cities of Essos and Westeros. The Gascari established outposts on its northern shores in the days of the old empire. They raised the walled city of Zamatar at the mouth of the river Zamoyas, and built a grim penal colony, Gorosh, on Wyvern Point. Carthian adventurers, hungry for profit, sought gold, gems, and ivory along the eastern coasts of Sothoris. Summer islanders did the same in the west. The freehold of Valeria thrice established colonies on Basilis Point. The first was destroyed by the Brindle men, the second lost to plague, and the third was abandoned when the Dragon Lords captured Zamatar in the Fourth Gascari War. Yet we cannot claim to know Sothoris well. Its interior remains a mystery to us, covered by impenetrable jungle, where ancient cities full of ghosts lie in ruins beside great, sluggish rivers. Only a few days' sail south of Basilis Point, even the shape of its coasts remains unknown. It may be that the summer islanders have explored and mapped these shorelines, but they guard their charts jealously and do not share such knowledge. Colonies planted here wither and die. Only Zamatar endured for more than a generation. And today, even that once great city is a haunted ruin, slowly being reclaimed by the jungle. Slavers, traders, and treasure hunters have visited Sothoris over the centuries, but only the boldest ever venture far from their coastal garrisons and enclaves to explore the mysteries of the continent's vast interior. Those that dare, more oft than not, set forth into the green, never to be seen again. We do not even know the true size of Sothoris. Carthian maps once showed it as an island, twice the size of Great Morak, but their trading ships, venturing farther and farther down the eastern coasts, were never able to find the bottom of it. The Gascari, who settled Zamatar and Gorish, believe Sothoris to be as large as Westeros. Jannara Valeris flew her dragon, Terex, farther south than any man or woman had ever gone before, seeking the boiling seas and the steaming rivers of legend, but found only endless jungle, deserts, and mountains. She returned to the freehold after 3 years to declare that Sothoris was as large as Essos, a land without end. Whatever its true extent, the southern continent is an unhealthy place, its very air full of foul humours and miasmas. We have already seen how Nymeria fared on its shores when she attempted to settle her people there. Blood boils, green fever, sweet rot, bronze pate, the red death, grey scale, brown leg, worm bone, sailor's bane, pus eye, and yellow gum are only a few of the diseases found there. Many so virulent that they have been known to wipe out whole settlements. Archmaester Ebro's study of centuries of travellers' accounts suggests that 9 of every 10 men visiting Sothoris from Westeros will suffer one or more of these afflictions, and that almost half will die. Nor is disease the only danger that those who seek to know this wet green land must face. Huge crocodiles lurk beneath the surface of the Zamoyas, and have been known to overturn boats, swimming up from below so they might devour their occupants as they struggle in the water. Other streams are infested by swarms of carnivorous fish capable of stripping the flesh from a man's bones in minutes. There are stinging flies, venomous snakes, wasps and worms that lay their eggs beneath the skins of horses, hogs, and men alike. Basilisks, both great and small, are found in great numbers on Basilisk Point, some twice the size of lions. In the forest south of Yin, there are said to be apes that dwarf the largest giants, so powerful they can slay elephants with a single blow. Farther south lie the regions known as the Green Hell, where beasts even more fearsome are said to dwell. There, if the tales can be trusted, are caverns full of pale white vampire bats who can drain the blood from a man in minutes. Tattooed lizards stalk the jungles, running down their prey and ripping them apart with the long curved claws on their powerful hind legs. Snakes 50 feet long slither through the underbrush, and spotted spiders weave their webs amongst the great trees. Most terrible of all are the wyverns, those tyrants of the southern skies, with their great leathery wings, cruel beaks, and insatiable hunger. Close kin to dragons, wyverns cannot breathe fire, but they exceed their cousins in ferocity, and are a match for them in all other respects save size. Brindle wyverns, with their distinctive jade and white scales, grow up to 30 feet long. Swamp wyverns have been known to attain an even greater size, though they are sluggish by nature and seldom fly far from their lairs. Brown bellies, no larger than monkeys, are even more dangerous than their larger kin, for they hunt in packs of 100 or more. But most dreaded of all is the shadow wing, a nocturnal monster whose black scales and wings make him all but invisible, until he descends out of the darkness to tear apart his prey.
In Septon Bath's Dragons, Worms, and Wyverns, he speculated that the blood mages of Valyria use wyvern stock to create dragons. Though the blood mages were alleged to have experimented mightily with their unnatural arts, this claim is considered far-fetched by most maesters. Among them, Maester Vanyan's Against the Unnatural contains certain proofs of dragons having existed in Westeros even in the earliest of days, before Valyria rose to be a power.
Unsurprisingly, Sothorius is thinly peopled when compared to Westeros or Essos. A score of small trade towns cling to the northern coast. Towns of mud and blood, as some say. Wet and humid and full of misery, where adventurers, rogues, exiles, and whores from the free cities and the seven kingdoms come to make their fortunes. There are riches hidden amongst the jungles and swamps and sullen, sun-baked rivers of the south beyond a doubt. But for every man who finds gold or pearls or precious spices, there are 100 who find only death. The corsairs of the Basilisk Isles prey upon these settlements, carrying off captives to holding pens on Talon and the Isle of Tears before selling them to the flesh markets of Slaver's Bay or the pillow houses and pleasure gardens of Lys. And the native races grow ever more savage and primitive the farther one travels from the coast. The Sothori are big-boned creatures, massively muscled, with long arms, sloped foreheads, huge square teeth, heavy jaws, and coarse black hair. Their broad, flat noses suggest snouts, and their thick skins are brindled in patterns of brown and white that seem more hug-like than human. Sothori women cannot breed with any save their own males, When mated with men from Essos or Westeros, they bring forth only stillbirths, many hideously malformed. The Sothori, that dwell closest to the sea, have learned to speak the trade talk. The Gescari consider them too slow of wit to make good slaves, but they are fierce fighters. Farther south, the trappings of civilization fall away, and the brindle men become even more savage and barbaric. These Sothori worship dark gods with obscene rites. Many are cannibals, and more are ghouls. When they cannot feast upon the flesh of foes and strangers, they eat their own dead. Some say there were other races here, once forgotten peoples destroyed, devoured, or driven out by the brindled men. Tales of lizard men, lost cities, and eyeless cave dwellers are commonplace. No proof exists for any of these.
Maesters and other scholars alike have puzzled over the greatest of the enigmas of Sothorius, the ancient city of Yin, a ruin older than time, built of oily black stone, in massive blocks so heavy that it would require a dozen elephants to move them. Yin has remained a desolation for many thousands of years, yet the jungle that surrounds it on every side has scarce touched it. A city so evil that even the jungle will not enter, Nymeria is supposed to have said when she laid eyes on it, if the tales are true. Every attempt to rebuild or resettle Yin has ended in horror.
The Grasslands. Beyond the forests of Kohor, Essos opens up upon a vast expanse of windswept plains, gentle rolling hills, fertile river valleys, great blue lakes, and endless steppes where the grass grows as high as a horse's head. From the forests of Kohor in the west to the towering mountains known as the Bones, the grasslands stretch more than 700 leagues. It was here, amidst these grasses, that civilization was born in the Dawn Age. 10,000 years ago or more, when Westeros was yet a howling wilderness inhabited only by the giants and children of the forest, the first true towns arose beside the banks of the River San and beside the myriad vassal streams that fed her on her meandering course northward to the Shivering Sea. The histories of those days are lost to us, sad to say, for the kingdoms of the grass came and went in large measure before the race of man became literate. Only the legends persist. From such we know of the Fisher Queens, who rule the lands adjoining the Silver Sea, the great inland sea at the heart of the grasslands. From a floating palace that made its way endlessly around its shores.
Sufficient tales survive to convince most maesters of the past existence of the Silver Sea, though because of diminishing rainfall over the centuries, it has shrunk so severely that today only three great lakes remain where once its waters glistened in the sun.
The Fisher Queens were wise and benevolent and favored of the gods, we are told. And kings and lords and wise men sought the floating palace for their counsel. Beyond their domains, however, other peoples rose and fell and fought, struggling for a place in the sun. Some maesters believe that the first men originated here before beginning the long westward migration that took them across the Arm of Dawn to Westeros. The Andals too may have arisen in the fertile fields south of the Silver Sea. Tales are told of the Hairy Men, a race of shaggy, savage warriors who rode to battle on unicorns. Though larger than the Ibanese of the present, they may well have been their forebears. We hear as well of the lost city of Liber, where acolytes of a spider goddess and a serpent god fought an endless bloody war. East of them stood the kingdoms of the centaurs, half man and half horse.
Archmaester Hagedorn has put forth the theory that the centaurs were no more than mounted warriors, as perceived by neighbouring tribes who had not yet learned to tame and ride horses. His views have become widely accepted at the Citadel, despite the purported centaur skeletons that turn up in grotesqueries from time to time.
In the southeast, the proud city-states of the Carthia rose. In the forest to the north, along the shores of the Shivering Sea, were the domains of the Woods Walkers, a diminutive folk whom many maesters believe to have been kin to the children of the forest. Between them could be found the hill kingdoms of the Cimmeri, the long-legged Gips with their wicker shields and lime-stiffened hair, and the brown-skinned, pale-haired Zecora, who rode to war in chariots. Most of these peoples are gone now, their cities burned and buried, their gods and heroes all but forgotten. Of the Carthy cities, only Carth remains, dreaming of past glories beside the jealously guarded jade gates, which link the summer and jade seas. The others were extinguished, driven into exile, or conquered and assimilated by the people who succeeded them. Westeros remembers the conquerors as the Sanori, for at its height their great kingdom included all the lands watered by the Sarn and its vassals, and the three great lakes that were all that remained of the shrinking Silver Sea. They called themselves the Tall Men, in their own tongue the Targes Fen. Long of limb and brown of skin they were, like the Zecora, though their hair and eyes were black as night. Warriors, sorcerers, and scholars, they traced their descent to the hero king they called Huzar Amai, the Amazing, born of the last of the Fisher Queens, who took to wife the daughters of the greatest lords and kings of the Gips, the Cimmeri, and the Zecora, binding all three peoples to his rule. His Zecora wife drove his chariot at his head. His Cimmer wife made his armor, for her people were the first to work iron, and he wore about his shoulders a great cloak made from the pelt of a king of the hairy men. Such a man may or may not ever have existed, but none can doubt the glory of the Tall Men at their height. A proud and quarrelsome people, they were seldom ever united under a single ruler, but their kingdoms dominated the western grasslands from the forest of Cohor to the eastern shore of the vanished Silver Sea and 50 leagues beyond. Their gleaming cities were strewn across the grasslands like jewels across a green velvet mantle, shining beneath the light of sun and stars. The greatest of these cities was Sarnath of the Tall Towers, where the High King dwelt in his fabled palace with 1,000 rooms.
By law and custom, all the lesser Sonori kings were subject to the High King. But in truth, very few of the High Kings ever exercised any real power.
Eastward rose Kasath, city of caravans, Sarthar, the waterfall city, at the juncture of 2 branches of the Sarn. Gornath, by the lake, with its canals. Selosh, by the Silver Shore, city of scholars, with its vast library and painted walls. Downstream, where the Sarn turns north, the prosperous river cities of Rathalar, Hornoth, and Kith served the ships that plied her deep blue waters. Here too stood Mardosh, the city of soldiers, renowned as Mardosh the Unconquerable. At the delta, where the Sarn splintered and flowed into the Shivering Sea, could be found the port of Sarth to the west and Sarris to the east. The kingdom of Sarnor, so-called, though it boasted 2 score rival kings, was amongst the known world's great civilizations for more than 2,000 years. yet much of what we know of them comes only from the fragments of their otherwise lost histories, most notably the summer and winter annals, and records of them from Kars, Slaver's Bay, and the Free Cities. Sonori traders travelled to Valeria and Yiti, to Leng and Ashai. Sonori ships sailed the Shivering Sea to Ib and the Thousand Islands and far Mosulvi. Sonori kings warred against the Ikathi and the old Empire of Gis, and led many a foray against the bands of nomadic horsemen who roamed the steppes to their east. Their riders wore steel and spider silk and rode coal-black mares, whilst the greatest of their warriors went to battle in scythed chariots pulled by teams of blood-red horses, oft-driven by their wives or daughters, for it was the custom amongst the Sonori for men and women to make war together. Even in the Seven Kingdoms, the glory of Sarnath of the Tall Towers was celebrated, and Lomas Lungstrider included the palace with 1,000 rooms amongst his 9 wonders made by man. Today, however, the kingdom of Sarna is largely forgotten, and there are many and more in Westeros, even students at the Citadel, who know little and less of its long, proud history. Their towers are all fallen, their cities ruined and abandoned, and noxious weeds and tall grasses grow where once the farms and fields and towns were found. The lands that they once ruled are but thinly peopled, and traversed only by the wandering khalasars of the Dothraki, horse lords, and such caravans as the Khals permit, to make the long, slow crossing from the Free Cities to Vaes Dothrak and the Mother of Mountains. Travellers name these the Haunted Lands, for the many ruined cities that dot them, or the Great Desolation, for their emptiness. But it is as the Dothraki Sea that these grasslands are best known today. That usage is comparatively recent, however, for the Dothraki are a young race, and it was only since the Doom destroyed Valeria that their khalasars came to dominate these lands, sweeping out of the east with fire and steel to conquer and destroy the ancient cities that once thrived here, and carrying off their peoples into bondage.
The old Empire of Gis fought 5 wars against the rising freehold of Valeria, history tells us. In the 2nd and 3rd Giscari Wars, the tall men took up their swords as allies of Valeria. In the 4th war, rival kings took opposite sides, some joining the Giscari and others the Valyrians. Lomas Longstrider wrote of a fallen obelisk, carved about with the figures of Gis's allies in that 4th war, and noted that the tallest warriors depicted, made taller by high helms, were the Sonori. The obelisk was raised by Gis, but the carvings were Valyrian, for all the warriors were captured and enslaved.
The fall of the great Sonori kingdoms took less than a century, even as the Free Cities of the West became locked in a savage struggle for domination during what became known as the Century of Blood. The grasslands, too, exploded into war. During the years that followed the Doom, the riders of the Eastern Steppes, hitherto divided into 60 quarrelsome tribes, at perpetual war with one another, had finally been united under a single leader, a Dothraki Khal called Mengo. Counseled by his mother, the purported witch queen Doshi, Khal Mengo compelled the other nomads to accept his rule, extinguishing or enslaving those who refused. Then, in his old age, he turned his eyes westward. Contemptuous of their horse lords, who had been no more than a nuisance to them for centuries, the tall men ignored the threat from the east for far too long. Even as the Khalasars began to raid across their eastern marches, some of their kings even sought to use the Dothraki in their own wars, offering them gold and slaves and other gifts to fight against their rivals. Kalmengo took these gifts gladly, then took the conquered lands as well, burning fields and farms and towns to return the grasslands to their wild state. For the Dothraki consider the earth to be their mother and think it sinful to cut her flesh with ploughs and spades and axes. Not until Mengo's son, Carl Moro, brought his Kalasar to the very gates of Sethar, the fabled waterfall city, did the tall men seem to realize their peril. Broken in battle, the men of Sethar were put to the sword, their women and children carried off as slaves. Three-quarters of them died on the grueling march south to slave marts at the Gascari Hill city, Hasdan Mo. Sethar, loveliest of the cities of the grasslands, was burned to ash and rubble. It is written that it was Carl Moro himself who gave the ruins their new name, Yali Kamai, the place of wailing children. Even then, the kings of Sarnor proved unable to unite. As Sethar burned, the kings of Kasath to the west and Gornath to the north sent forth their armies, not to aid their neighbors, but to lay claim to a share of the plunder. In their greed for land, Kasath and Gornath even came into conflict with one another, and fought a pitched battle 3 days' ride west of Sethar, as plumes of black smoke rose in the eastern sky. This is not the place to chronicle the events of the years and wars that followed. As the great cities of the kingdoms of Sarnor fell piecemeal to the Dothraki. Those who wish a more detailed account are directed to Bellows, The End of the Tall Men, Maester Illustr's Horse Tribes being a study of the nomads of the eastern plains of Essos, the eastern chapters and appendices of Maester Joseph's Battles and Sieges of the Century of Blood, and Vigoro's definitive Ruined Cities, Stolen Gods. Let it suffice to say that of all the proud Sonori cities, only Sarth remains unruined today, and that port city is a sad place, much diminished from what it once was, surviving largely because of support from Ib and Loreth, whose colony of Morash is nearby. Only in Sarth do men still name themselves Targa's Fen. Fewer than 20,000 remain, when once the tall men numbered in the millions. Only there are the 100 gods of the kingdom of Sarnor still worshipped. The bronze and marble likenesses that once adorned the streets and temples of the tall men now lean crookedly, overgrown by weeds, along the grassy ways of Vaes Dothrak, the sacred city of the horse lords. Sethar was the first of the cities of the grasslands to fall to the Dothraki, but by no means the last. 6 years later, Carl Moro raised Kasath as well. In this attack, his riders were aided, incredibly, by Gornath, whose king had made common cause with the Dothraki and taken one of Moro's daughters to wife. Yet Gornath itself fell next, a dozen years afterward. Carl Horro had by that time slain Carl Moro, ending the line of the mighty Carl Mengo. The king of Gornath died at the hand of his own Dothraki wife, who despised him for his weakness, we are told. Afterward, Carl Horro took her for his own, as rats devoured the corpse of her late husband. Horro was the last of the great Carls to command the allegiance of all Dothraki. When he was slain by a rival, only 3 years after the destruction of Gornath, his great Kalasar splintered into a dozen lesser hordes, and the riders once again resumed their quarrelsome ways. Yet the reprieve this provided the kingdom of Sarnor proved short-lived, for the tall men had shown their weakness, and the Carls who followed Horro shared his taste for conquest. In the years that followed, they strove to outdo one another by conquering ever wider territories, destroying the cities of the grasslands, enslaving their peoples, and carrying their broken gods back to Vaes Dothrak to testify to their victories. One by one, the remaining cities of the tall men were overwhelmed and destroyed, leaving only ruins and ashes to mark where their proud towers once stood. For scholars and students of history, the fall of Salash by the Silver Shore was especially tragic. For when that city of scholars burned, its great library was not spared, and most of the history of the tall men and the peoples who had gone before them were lost for all time. Kith and Hornoth soon followed, destroyed by rival Khals, each of whom sought to outdo the other in savagery. The fortress city, Mardosh, the unconquerable, defied the Horselands the longest. For close unto 6 years the city endured, cut off from its hinterlands, encircled by a succession of khalasars, driven to starvation, the Mardashi devoured their dogs and horses, then rats and mice and other vermin, and finally began to eat their own dead. When they could endure no longer, the surviving warriors of the city garrison slew their own wives and children to keep them from the Khals, then opened the city gates and rushed forth for one final attack. They were cut down to a man. Afterwards, the Dothraki named the ruins of Mardosh Vaes Gorkhai, the city of the blood charge. The fall of Mardosh finally awakened the remaining Sanori kings to the depth of their peril. Putting aside their own quarrels and rivalries at last, the tall men gathered from up and down the San, assembling a great army beneath the walls of Sarnath, intent on breaking the power of the Khals for good and all. Led by Mazor Alexei, last of the High Kings, they struck out boldly to the east. In the tall grass, halfway between Sarnath and the ruins of Kasath, they met the assembled power of 4 khalasars on what forever after was known as the Field of Crows. Karl Harrow, Karl Kano, Karl Lasso, the lame, and Karl Zako commanded almost 80,000 horsemen between them, we are told. The great host of the High King of Sarno was led by 6,000 scythed chariots, with 10,000 armored riders behind them, and another 10,000 light horsemen, many of them women, on the flanks. Behind them marched the Sanari foot, close to 100,000 spearmen and slingers, giving the tall men a great advantage in numbers. On this all chroniclers agree. As battle was joined, the Sanori chariots threatened to carry all before them. Their earth-shattering advance smashed through the center of the Dothraki horde, the spinning blades on the wheels of their chariots slicing through the legs of the Dothraki horses. When Karl Harrow himself went down before them, cut to pieces and trampled, his khalasar broke and fled. As the chariots thundered after the fleeing horsemen, the High King and his armored riders plunged in after them, followed by the Sanori foot, waving their spears and screaming victory. Their elation was short-lived. The rout was feigned. When they had drawn the tall men deep into the trap, the fleeing Dothraki turned suddenly and unleashed a storm of arrows from their great bows. The khalasars of Karl Kano and Karl Zako swept in from north and south, while Lasso the Lame and his screamers circled round and attacked the Sanori from the rear, cutting off their retreat. Completely encircled, the High King and his mighty host were cut to pieces. Some say 100,000 men died that day, amongst them Mazor Alexei, 6 lesser kings, and more than 60 lords and heroes. As the crows feasted on their corpses, The riders of the Kailasars walked amongst the dead and squabbled over their valuables. Bereft of defenders, Sarnath of the Tall Towers fell to Lasso the Lame less than a fortnight later. Not even the palace with 1,000 rooms was spared when Carl Lasso put the city to the torch. The remaining cities of the grasslands followed one by one, as the century of blood drew to its close. Sarus, at the mouth of the Sarn, was the last to fall, but yielded little in the way of slaves or plunder, for the people of the city had largely fled by the time that Carl Zecco descended upon it. It must not be thought that the kingdom of Sarnor was the only victim of the horse lords. The Valyrian colony Assyria, sometimes remembered as the Lost Free City, was similarly overwhelmed. Today its ruins are known to the Dothraki as Vaes Cadoc, the City of Corpses. In the north, Carl Adako sacked and burned Ibish, reclaiming most of the small foothold the men of Ib had carved out on the northern coast of Essos. A much smaller Ibanese colony survives in the dense forests beside the Shivering Sea, huddled around the town they have named New Ibish. In the south, other Carls led their hordes into the Red Waste, destroying the Carthy towns and cities that once dotted that desert. Until only the great city of Carth remained, protected by its towering triple wall.
Despite their long history, little can be said with any certainty of the Carthy, a people now gone from the world save for a remnant in Carth. What can be said is that the Carthy arose in the grasslands and established towns there, coming into contact and occasional conflict with the Sonori. They would oft have the worst of these wars, and so began to drift farther south, creating new city-states. One such, Carth, was founded on the coast of the Summer Sea. Yet the lands in the south of Essos proved more inhospitable than those the Carthy had vacated, turning to desert even as they established their foothold there. The Carthy people were already well on their way to collapse when the doom struck, and any hopes of using the chaos in the Summer Sea to their advantage vanished when the Dothraki attacked, destroying all the remaining Carthy cities save for Carth itself. Yet, in a way, the Dothraki destruction led to a resurgence for Carth. Forced to look instead to the sea, the Pureborn, who ruled Carth, swiftly constructed a fleet and took control of the Jade Gates, the strait between Carth and Great Morak, which joins the Summer Sea to the Jade Sea. With the Valyrian fleet destroyed and Volantis's attention turned west, there were none to oppose them as they established control over the most direct route between east and west, and so gained immeasurably in both trade and levied tolls for safe passage.
Many in the Free Cities believe that the westward thrust of the Horse Lords was turned back at Kohor, when Carl Temmo's attempt to take that city was defeated by the valor of 3,000 on solid slave soldiers who stood fast against 18 charges of his screamers. To believe that the stand of the 3,000 of Kohor put an end to Dothraki dreams of conquest, however, suggests a complacency akin to that of the High King of Sarnor's, when the Horse Lords first came boiling out of the east. Wiser men know that it is only a matter of time until the Kailasars unite again under some great Carl and turn west once more in search of new conquests. The Dothraki have oft attempted to extend their power eastward as well, but there they have found the Bone Mountains to be an almost insurmountable obstacle. Those bleak, inhospitable peaks form an immense stone wall between the Horse Lords and the riches of the further east. Only three passes exist large enough to bring an army through. And athwart those stand the mighty fortress cities, Bayasabad, Samariana, and Kayakayanaya, defended by tens of thousands of redoubtable female warriors, the last remnants of the great kingdom of Harkun, which once flourished beyond the bones in what is now known as the Great Sand Sea. Many a Karl has died beneath their walls, and still those walls stand inviolate.
It is said that the fortress cities of Bayasabad, Samiriana, and Kayakayanaya are defended by women out of the belief that those who give birth are the only ones permitted to take life at will. The true account of Adam of Duskendale's journeys, a merchant's account of his alleged travels in eastern Essos, provides little further insight into these matters, or any others that scholars are interested in, and instead spends most of its time finding ways to remind readers that the warrior women walk about bare-breasted and decorate their cheeks and nipples with ruby studs and iron rings.
West of the bones, however, from the shivering sea in the north to the painted mountains and Skahazadan in the south, the vast expanse of grass where civilization first flowered remains a windswept desolation where no man dares plow a furrow, plant a seed, or raise a house for fear of the Kalasars that wander freely there to this very day, exacting gifts from any man who seeks to cross their lands and making war upon each other. The Dothraki remain nomads still, a savage and wild people who prefer tents to palaces. Seldom still, the Karls drive their great herds of horses and goats endlessly across their sea, fighting one another when they meet and occasionally moving beyond the borders of their own lands for slaves and plunder, or to claim the gifts that the magisters and triarchs of the free cities bestow upon them whenever they chance to wander too far west. The horse lords have only one permanent settlement, the city they call Vaes Dothrak, which stands beneath the shadow of the lonely peak they call the Mother of Mountains, beside a bottomless lake they name the Womb of the World. It is here that the Dothraki believe their race was born. No true city, Vaes Dothrak, has neither walls nor streets. Its grassy thoroughfares are lined with stolen gods, its palaces made of woven grass. This hollow shell of a city is ruled by women, the crones of the Dash Kalin, all widows of dead Karls. The Dothraki esteem Vaes Dothrak as the holiest of cities. No blood may be shed there, for the riders believe this to be a place of peace and power, where one day all the Kalasars shall gather together once more beneath the banners of the great Karl who will conquer all, the stallion who mounts the world. For us, however, the only true importance of Vaes Dothrak is the trading that takes place there. The Dothraki themselves will neither buy nor sell, deeming it unmanly. But in their sacred city, by leave of the Dash Kalin, merchants and traders from beyond the bones and the free cities come together to haggle and exchange goods and gold. The caravans that feed the great eastern and western markets of Vaes Dothrak give handsome gifts to the Karls they meet crossing the Dothraki Sea, and in return receive protection. So, strange to say, this empty city of the nomads has become the gateway between east and west for those who travel by land. Many distant peoples who might not otherwise meet or even know of one another gather here in this queer bazaar beneath the Mother of Mountains and trade in safety. The Shivering Sea. The Shivering Sea is bounded to the west by Westeros, to the south by Essos, to the north by the vast frozen wilderness of ice and snow that seafarers call the White Waste, and to the east by lands and seas unknown. The true extent of this vast, chilly, inhospitable ocean may never be known, for no man of the seven kingdoms has ever sailed farther east than the Thousand Islands, whilst those who venture too far north encounter howling winds, frozen seas, and mountains of ice that can crush even the strongest ship. Beyond them, sailors tell us, blizzards rage eternally, and the very mountains themselves scream like madmen in the night. It has long been accepted amongst the wise that our world is round. If this is true, it ought to be possible to sail over the top of the world and down its far side, and there discover lands and seas undreamed of. Over the centuries, many a bold mariner has sought to find a way through the ice to whatever lies beyond. Most, alas, have perished in the attempt, or returned south again, half frozen and much chastened. Whilst it is true that the White Waste recedes during summer and expands again in winter, its very shorelines ever changing, no seafarer has succeeded in finding this fabled northern passage, nor the warm summer sea that Maester Harriston of White Harbour once suggested might lie hidden and entombed behind the icy cliffs of the far north. Sailors, by nature a gullible and superstitious lot, as fond of their fancies as singers, tell many tales of these frigid northern waters. They speak of queer lights shimmering in the sky, where the demon mother of the ice giants dances eternally through the night, seeking to lure men northward to their doom. They whisper of Cannibal Bay, where ships enter at their peril, only to find themselves trapped forever when the sea freezes hard behind them. They tell of pale blue mists that move across the waters, mists so cold that any ship they pass over is frozen instantly, of drowned spirits who rise at night to drag the living down into the grey-green depths, of mermaids pale of flesh with black-scaled tails, far more malign than their sisters of the south.
Legend claims 1,000 ships lie entombed in Cannibal Bay, some still inhabited by the children and grandchildren of their original crews, who survive by feasting upon the flesh of sailors newly caught by the ice.
Of all the queer and fabulous denizens of the shivering sea, however, the greatest are the ice dragons. These colossal beasts, many times larger than the dragons of Valyria, are said to be made of living ice, with eyes of pale blue crystal and vast translucent wings through which the moon and stars can be glimpsed as they wheel across the sky. Whereas common dragons, if any dragon can truly be said to be common, breathe flame, ice dragons supposedly breathe cold, a chill so terrible that it can freeze a man solid in half a heartbeat. Sailors from half a hundred nations have glimpsed these great beasts over the centuries, so perhaps there is some truth behind the tales. Archmaester Margate has suggested that many legends of the north, freezing mists, ice ships, Cannibal Bay and the like, can be explained as distorted reports of ice dragon activity. Though an amusing notion, and not without a certain elegance, this remains the purest conjecture. As ice dragons supposedly melt when slain, no actual proof of their existence has ever been found. Let us put aside such fancies and return to fact. Despite the sinister legends that have grown up around its northerly reaches, the waters of the Shivering Sea teem with life. Hundreds of varieties of fish swim through its depths, including salmon, wolffish, sand lancers, grey skates, lampreys,